Don't you take my wig off.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Take it off.
I can look at you. We're not.
You can take my tam off. You can get this off.
You want to take that off?
Yeah, you can take the tam off. But leave my wig alone.
Oh, baby, baby. Don't you take that off your wig.
Now when you tell me lies, it breaks my heart, too, baby.
On a late winter afternoon in Lafayette, Louisiana, five musicians have crowded into an intimate studio to record some tunes for a blues CD. Amidst all this talent, there's no question who is the real star here, 76-year-old Carol Fran with her husky voice, chestnut-colored wig, and wrists full of jangly bracelets. Fran has been making music for longer than these other musicians have been alive, growling and shimmying and dazzling audiences from Shreveport to Sao Paulo. Today, even as she recovers from a mini stroke, she's recording in the two languages she learned growing up in a Creole family here in Lafayette. With all the rich music coming out of South Louisiana and New Orleans, like jazz, zydeco, and Cajun, it's easy to overlook the blues. Yet all along the Interstate 10 corridor, older musicians like Carol Fran continue to sing and play the blues, despite poverty, illness, and disasters like Hurricane Katrina. Over the next hour, you'll hear the songs and the stories of three such musicians on this radio special, Still Singing the Blues.
One of those dirt babies who came up from the ground with nothing. So I learned how to survive with whole cakes and sweet water for breakfast, and whole cakes and homemade preserve for dinner at night. I started at about 5 years old. My mama had an old aunt that took me to church with her, and they had taught me one of these old Negro spirituals, and I sang that in the church the very first time. So when I came back home, I told my mom that I had sang in the church. And she wanted to know what I sang. And I told her I wanted to be a movie star because I could sing. Well, as I got a little bit older, about 13, 14 years old, right here in the city of Lafayette, about two blocks down the street was where we lived, right over there on Enos Street. And there was a band that, in those days, you know, we had the traveling bands that would come and stay. We had no black hotels. They stayed in various Negro homes that had a lot of rooms. They'd rent the bands a room, and there was a band. There was a house. There was an old lady that lived about a quarter of a mile up the street there near the bakery shop. She had a band at her house called the Don Conway Band. They were from Monroe, Louisiana. Some people told this... the band leader, Don Conway, that there was a little girl in this town that could sing. And we had a little, we call them ice cream parlors in those days, little places we'd go and get sandwiches and sodas. And they played in there. And I told him I could do Stardust. I went in there and did Stardust. And he was furious because I was scatting Stardust. you don't do that to songs like that. That's not the way you do them. I said, well, that's the way I do it.
A few years later, Conway came back through town and hired Fran to sing with his orchestra. The group traveled for 3 or 4 months, and when Fran came home, she had more money than her family had ever seen.
At that time, my mom was working and making $7.50 a week, and I was making $7.50 a night, working 5 nights a week. So there was like a fortune for us. When I came back from that very first trip, it was around November when I came home to my mom. And in this neighborhood, right in this area, just a couple of blocks over, was nobody in the neighborhood. In fact, nobody on this side of the track had a washing machine. So the man passed with a washing machine on his truck. We call them dollar down, dollar when you catch them. You put $5 down on the washing machine, and then $1 a week when he passed. And it was Thanksgiving time. So I said, I want to buy that. He said, you don't have the kind of money. So I pull out my little stash. And he said, yeah, you do what you do. And I told him what I did. He said, well, okay. He said, I'm going to pass here every Tuesday. And every Tuesday, I want $1.50. I said, you got it. He put that washing machine on the porch. This is about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And my mom was working in a pressing shop. My mom turned the corner. And when she turned the corner, everybody in the neighborhood was at our front gate looking at the washing machine. They knew what it was, but nobody had one. She thought something was wrong with one of the children because there were 7 of us. So she started running. When she got to the house, she saw what it was. She said, oh my goodness, I thought somebody was dead around here. So her neighbor said, no, honey. She said, you just became a rich woman. So my mama said, hi. She said, look what you got on your porch. My mama said, where'd that come from? I said, happy Thanksgiving, Mom. I can see the expression on my mama's face right now. She was so happy. She sat on the steps and she started to cry. And that's how it began. That night, she washed with an audience. She washed on the porch with an audience.
Young Carol was also developing quite an audience. After touring with Don Conway, she moved to New Orleans, where she performed in bars in and around Bourbon Street. Her dynamic voice earned her the nickname the Sarah Vaughan of the Vieux Carré. In 1957, she met the man who would inspire her first hit.
Came home. There's a club here, they just reopened it, called the Birdcage. Emmett Lee was a traveling salesman working for men's fashion, McGregor Men's Fashion. And he came here to have a fashion show. They were going to sell some suits here, he and this guy that worked. And he was in the club. So when I walk in there, he said, now there's the girl of my dream. And I looked around, I said, who are you? I sat at the bar and had a drink. And we wound up spending the whole evening together. And he had to leave the next day. Oh, I had me a humdinger that night. So I had given him my telephone number. He'd called, but I was asleep. And if I was asleep, you could forget it. My mama wouldn't wake me up. My mama said, you had a phone call from somebody named Emmett. Said he'd be back in a few days. And oh, my heart was so broken. I went out again hoping that he'd still be here. But I didn't see him anymore because he had already gone. Then I got the blues. I went on a binge for about a week. And I'd come home at night and play my old piano. And finally, I mean, I wanted him to come back. So this is a song that I'm begging, I'm pleading to hear from. It's a true story.
Lee's plaintive sound was typical of the Creole rhythm and blues coming out of the Gulf Coast at the time. Fran says she earned only $27 from the record, a familiar story for many African American musicians. But the song boosted Fran's reputation. She toured a circuit that included the Apollo Theater in New York and the Million Dollar Theater in Los Angeles, and she became a regular at the Dewdrop Inn, the most celebrated black-owned nightclub in New Orleans.
A little old shabby hole in the wall with a restaurant in the back where all the musicians would go there when they get off from their gigs, especially on weekends. They used to do it every night because, you know, New Orleans at that time, there was entertainment every night. But especially on weekends, they go back there and they would have red beans and rice, red beans, pigtails and rice, or meatballs and spaghetti. And if you went there in the morning about 4 or 5 o'clock, maybe you could get some bacon and eggs and toast. And it's a little bit old shabby place, but it looked like the biggest place in the world. Everybody went there. Ray Charles. Everybody that had a name and went to New Orleans, they'd go to the Dewdrop. And you couldn't go down LaSalle Street because the cars would be parked all the way 3 abreast. So you have to make it out the best way you could, park way down the street and walk back. Then next door to the little club, they had a barbershop. And then upstairs, they had an old hotel. And in the back, they had some rooms where when it rained, you needed an umbrella in your room when it rained. But that was heaven for everybody.
At the Dewdrop, Fran met Clarence Holloman, the blues guitarist who, many years later, would become both her soulmate and her greatest musical partner.
Old Sam Myers, you remember Sam Myers, the old harmonica, blind harmonica player? We were all in the Dewdrop one day and I was sitting at the lunch counter eating, so it was time to pay for it. So Clarence said, "I'll pay for it. How much is it?" So the man said, 52 cents. Sam Myers is sitting in the studio that day. He said, "You know, Clarence, I've been meaning to tell you that." He said, "If I had known that all it took Carol to get Carol was 52 cents, he said, I'd have bought her the whole restaurant."
More on the partnership of her lifetime when we return with Still Singing the Blues. This is Richard Ziegler. By the time Carol Fran met blues guitarist Clarence Holloman again, 25 years later, the first wave of her musical career had crested. She sang at hotel lounges in Miami for a while, then moved to Houston to be near her ailing mother.
When I met him again, I wasn't sure it was him. And then I asked him later on, I said, do you really remember me? He said, "Yes, I remember." He even told me what I had on and how I looked. I used to wear blonde wigs all the time. He said you had a blonde hair, you had a white leather coat, and he said you always had a handful of diamonds. I love jewelry. And he said, "Yes, I remember you." He said it would be hard to forget you, but he had been married and had 2 children after that, you know. He even remembers that I told him, "Oh no, we can't be together because you married." And my mama said, "No married men." My mama used to tell me that all the time. Remember, no married men.
As a duo, with her on the piano Helm on the guitar, and both of them singing, Fran and Holloman fed off each other's talent and energy. They left an audience at the 1994 Chicago Blues Festival in rapt silence. They began playing gigs throughout Europe and got a deal with New Orleans Blacktop Records. They performed together until Holloman died in 2000.
You know what? He could have made it on his own, and I'm not sure, but I think I could have made it on my own too, but in a different way. When we got together, they said we were two powerhouses together. We went to Europe so much that all the people, when we come through the immigration, everybody knew us. Oh man, they would roll the red carpet for us, especially in Germany. Every other month, we'd come home for 30 days, and then we was going back. We spent more time in Europe. Oh man, I was almost a European citizen. We even did the Atlanta Olympics. I said, well, what did you all do? We were riding on a cart. We used to do this Clarence would do it in the airport. You know, they don't blow no horns in the airport. Clarence like say, watch the cart. And say, well, what did you all do for the Olympics? Clarence say, I hollered, watch the cart longer than anybody else. They'd ride us all over the grounds. Watch the cart. And that's not what we did. We opened had an amusement park, an entertaining park. And that's what we opened for them. We played 3 days in there.
I'm Marcia Ball. I live in Austin, Texas, and I am a piano player and singer. I met Carol and Clarence Holloman back in the late 80s. I just latched on. I knew I had found a mentor and a friend. There was a great show at the Woodlands Amphitheater called the Cradle Concert. And we were on it, and they asked if I wanted to bring a guest, anybody who would, in my opinion, epitomize the Gulf Coast sound. And I immediately thought of Carol and Clarence. They came and played with us, and it was just remarkable. I learned not only how to play and how to do a show and how to deal with an audience, but that night on this big stage, everybody's dressed up, but Clarence and Carol are both wearing white. She's wearing this beautiful white chiffon dress with rhinestones down the front, and he's wearing a white double-breasted suit. And I've seen pictures of that night, and you can't see anything else on the stage but those white suits just glowing in the lights. And so I thought, you know, that is one of those important showbiz lessons that I would never have learned any other way.
So great was their chemistry that Fran and Holloman could make a big sound with no other musicians except themselves. In 1993, Germany's Radio Bremen made this recording of them.
Think it's a full band, but it's not. It's just two pieces, piano and guitar. But he played so much guitar, you didn't need nothing else. And think, with no drummer, I had some shoe heels. I used to wear high heels all the time. My foot was a metronome. Oh man, when that man died, he took my soul with him. I died too. I'm just here physically, but I died too, because it's, for me, it's as though that was the end of my musical career.
Even after 10 years, Carol Fran's grief for her husband is palpable. The past decade has been hard. She's had a string of health setbacks, including a stroke in 2007 that compromised her ability to play piano. She lives alone these days in a public housing community on the north side of Lafayette. But Holloman's death was not the end of Fran's career. At 76, she's still singing. Last year, she traveled to Sao Paulo, Brazil, to sing at Bourbon Street Fest, which showcases Louisiana culture. Here's her friend, Becky Owens.
You could just see her light up when she got up on stage, and she just saw how much they welcomed her, and, you know, and she just really, she belts it out. I mean, she just gets up there and belts out her songs, and the first night, she had on this gold and green sequins dress. You know, the crowd was just, you know, she came out, and they were, you know, crazy about it. We had a driver, you know, somebody that would come and pick us up each time we had to go, you know, somewhere. And this girl was, she commented so much on Carol's dress that night. The next day, she came to pick us up, and Carol had her dress in a paper bag and gave it to our, you know, the girl that was driving us around. And, you know, she's just that way.
A few months later, some friends threw Fran a birthday party at Cruisers, a cinder block bar at the edge of Lafayette. They had pork chops, red beans and rice, and a birthday cake with candles. Fran wore her trademark blonde wig and a spangled cap in Mardi Gras colors. Well-wishers pinned dollar bills to her lacy black dress. She sang, of course, leaning over, touching the floor, and gyrating her hips for the crowd. Her growl that night remained undiminished. Back, a TV repairman and guitarist recalls Louisiana's rural juke joints as Still Singing the Blues continues.
Honey, I'm gonna pick up my salary when I leave here. I don't work this hard for money, but I'll never be 76 again.
Hey, count them on three. Sakas Walker, Shelby.
You're listening to Still Singing the Blues. I'm Richard Ziegler. Louisiana is famous as a wellspring of American music, but when outsiders think of the Pelican State, they rarely think of the blues. The scene has historically existed below the radar, in juke joints and neighborhood bars from Baton Rouge in the south to Tallulah in the north. Yet the DNA of the blues can be found everywhere in Louisiana music, in jazz, in zydeco, in funk, and rhythm and blues. Even in New Orleans, best known for its jazz, the blues have always been around, at house parties and fish fries in neighborhoods all over town. Here's guitarist Ernie Vincent.
You gotta stop and think about majority of the people that was here from, they was all from the countryside, and that's all they did. They worked hard, they farmed, and they played blues on the weekend. And that would make B.B. King so popular here, and Bobby Blue Bland back in the day, John Lee Hook and all that kind of stuff. They played that on the radio station constantly, especially on the black radio station, they played that constantly. The blues was always in the world.
The city where the blues trumps all other traditional music is the state capital, Baton Rouge. Here's Johnny Palazzotto, director of the Baton Rouge Blues Foundation.
We like to call ourselves the blues stronghold. In the middle of the most musical 125 miles on earth. You know, we spawned Buddy Guy, Slim Harpo, Keith Richards and Mick Jagger both have been quoted as saying, why would you want to hear the Rolling Stones do I'm a King Bee when you can listen to Rudy Richard and Slim Harpo do it?
Of course, in the army of bluesmen that used to perform in this area, not everyone got that type of recognition. This homemade CD is one of the few recordings of 73-year-old Harvey Knox, a prolific sideman who played guitar with almost every well-known blues artist to come out of Baton Rouge, including Slim Harpo.
Slim Harpo. He was a junk hustler, you know, and I was a junk hustler. So we meet up in the junkyard. We meet up, we meet on the gigs. When he got where he was trying to travel alone with just him and his guitar, I played with a group called Buddy Stewart and the Top Notches. So he would travel with our band, you know, little gigs, not way out of town, but couple of hundred mile radius. Tallulah, Louisiana. It is the heart of the Louisiana Delta. It was a, the little town was, they called it Little Vegas. It was open 24 hours a day. And they had everything there. Everything. Two highways, Highway 80 and Highway 65 intersected in Tallulah. So the traffic had to pass through it. They had two dance halls. They always had people like B.B. King, Guitar Slim, Roy Milton. Just about anybody you name would come through there and play. They always have good shows, either one of them. Good food, a lot of gambling, you know. Everywhere you go, would go during that time was, if you went into a bar or a cafe, and you go into the back of it, they had a gambling table, and they shot dice through a horn, you know, just instead of rolling them dice, you put them through a horn. I guess that probably was the Vegas style of shooting dice. Always good food. You could buy an egg sandwich, you could buy a bologna sandwich, and you could buy a bowl of stew, which you can't find no more. It's blues country. Nothing but the blues. The children came up in the bar. Just about, you know, we have people come from out of the country with the children to make grocery, and while they're in town, they would go to the bar. Yeah, the boy sit over there, and they'd get them a little drink. I might just be in that waiting until everybody get ready to go back to the country. But we was in the bar room at an early age. I was in the bar 11 or 12 years old, you know. Cause my grandfather, he used to go to the pool hall and I would go with him. Matter of fact, I got a job in the pool hall at 12, racking pool.
When Knox was not in the pool hall, he was pulling corn, picking cotton, and chopping wood. In 1957, he moved to Baton Rouge to study music at Southern University. He was the first member of his sharecropping family to go to college, and his aunt had to sell a cow to help him get there. The blues Knox discovered in Baton Rouge sounded different from the Delta blues of his hometown in North Louisiana. Here's the music Knox grew up with. ¶¶
That's all compared to what they was playing in Tallulah. When it got down here, they started playing called the Baton Rouge Blues. That's what developed the Baton Rouge Blues is. But the blues is, they got a scale that you play. That's a blues scale, so, and it's a form, like a 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, it's 12 bars. It's always, it's using 7 chords. Nine. You play like you. Well, a musician play like he's singing.
After college, Knox began playing blues guitar full time.
I was playing 7 jobs a week, so I played 2 matinees. And 7 nights. That was a lot. But all you have time to do during that time is wake up and try to get ready for the next gig. I had a 47 Chevrolet. Put the whole band in that car and go make a gig. We had bass, guitars, saxophone, and a drummer. Probably had a singer in there too. For the people who, like barbers and beauticians, people who was off on Monday, they'd have a Monday matinee. Start maybe, 1 or 2 o'clock in the evening, last over in the evening. They would have a Saturday matinee. And across the river in West Baton Rouge Parish, the club stayed open. They didn't have a curfew there. So if we played on this side of the river, and got off at 1 o'clock. I think the curfew was 1 o'clock over here. We would ride across the river and it'd be daylight before we get home.
Back then, the juke joints seemed to rise everywhere out of the cane fields. But Knox's work fell off during the 70s and 80s and it never quite recovered. These days he plays at a nursing home with funding from the Jazz Foundation of America. He also has a weekly gig playing blues, soul, and R&B at a night spot called Club Infinity. He supplements this income by repairing TVs and other electronics out of his modest Baton Rouge home. The Baton Rouge Blues Foundation is working to revive this heritage by sending musicians into classrooms and sponsoring an annual blues festival. Still, Knox says, the scene is not what it used to be.
It's not good. We don't have the clubs that cater to the blues. But most of the clubs, they got a mixture of stuff. They got a DJ with big old stack of speakers and stuff. They cater to the young folks until they find out that, it's too much trouble and they try to quit. They try to go to the blues. But we don't have enough going on for musicians to make a living around here, not playing the blues. You have to be ready to move, to go somewhere away from here to make some money.
When we come back, a New Orleans journey from the Bucket of Blood to the Last Chance Lounge, when Still Singing the Blues continues.
Down on 1800 block, Parker Street. Man, they love to do the Parker Street boogie. So I look around the room. They had some fine, beautiful young women in there. They were just done the Parker Street boogie. Some of them small, and some of them fat. Some of them skinny, and some of them tall. All it was done, the Park Street Boogie. Don't cut my throat. They want to cut your throat when you start a boogie woogie, you know, but I didn't want them to cut mine.
You're listening to Still Singing the Blues. I'm Richard Ziegler.
That's why I made the song Crackhead Joe. Crackhead Joe, he was a dog fellow, real dog, and he used to fool with that crack, and then he used to drink this, he'd take a mixture, you know, in different bottles and things, he'd pick up and pour this wine in there, and pour that wine in there, and pour this liquor in there, but he had a mix-up drink, he would drink that, and then he fool with that crack, and then he'd be knocked out. And there, underneath the bridge, stretched out on a cardboard box. Knocked out, don't know when to wake up and go eat something. And so I said, well, and his name was Joe. And so I said, well, that's Crackhead Joe.
Little Freddie King is visiting his old block of Pogger Street, where the New Orleans musician lived shortly before Hurricane Katrina. This corner of the city's 7th Ward is a checkerboard of double shotgun houses and vacant lots. On the corner, a faded sign featuring a martini glass and two guitars hangs from a rusted pole over a neighborhood bar. Its brick siding is spray painted with the words, "No Loitering."
That's what they call a last chance lounge. That's why I made the song of Park Street Boogie. And that's why I went down there and talked to my old friend, Ernie Cato, and Marshan, and Earl Kane. All the rest of my old guys right there. They said, come on up here, man. Sit down. It's time for a cold one. They was playing in the jukebox, you know, thinking and drinking. First Stop Lounge is the name of it. But actually, I give the name of Last Chance Lounge because that's the last place you could get some liquor from if it's after 10 o'clock at night. So that's why I give it the name of the Last Chance Lounge.
Pogger Street is not just where King lived, it's also one of the places where he has drawn inspiration. For most of his 69 years, King has been converting his hard life into some of the grittiest gut bucket blues in New Orleans. While others have veered into more commercial R&B, King has kept his sound raw. Its roots can be found in Macomb, Mississippi, the Delta town where he grew up.
We would do sharecropping. Me and my dad. And so we have to pick cotton, you know, maybe like from dawn, you know, where you first see a little bit, all the way up until 8, 9, 10 o'clock at night. When the moon be shining, you know, when it's kind of moon shining bright, then you kind of see what we've done. And we work hard, 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 you know, picking cotton. And that's actually what, you know, that really put the roots of the blues in us because what we came through, it had such a hard time. Maybe we might make 20 bales of cotton. Each bale of cotton run about from $600 to $700 during that time. And we don't care how much we picked or whatnot or how many hundred, they wouldn't pay for like $2 for a hundred.
Yeah, I'm going down the mountain, babe.
So I always hear my daddy say, get out there early and pick the cotton when the dew is on it and make it more heavy. So I got out there instead of thinking what to do was on the cotton. I take the drinking water. You know, it have drinking water. Oh, big 5-gallon can. So I pour the drinking water in the cotton. So we got there and weighed it up. So I had about 400 pounds. My daddy said, come here, boy. He used to call me. If he didn't call me a boy, he called me Bud. He said, come here, Bud. I said, what is it, Dad? He said, let me tell you something. It's cause we getting cheated. Don't you cheat nobody. You be honest.
I'm going down the mountain, babe. Place I never been before. Yeah, I'm going down the mountain. Place I never been before.
From his musician father, King inherited a love of the blues and an itch to see other places. When he was a teenager, he hopped a freight train to New Orleans with a dream that life would be better there.
You know, the almost steam in, you run fast. And so it was coming, so, and I was watching, you know, the rafters, you know, the little ladder go up and down the side of it. And I lashed on to it. When I lashed on to it, it straightened me out and it had me flopping like a kite. Man, I'm telling you, it flopped me maybe about 3 or 4 miles almost. And then when it started slowing down some, then that's when I got a chance to crawl around and get inside of the car. Got right there at the Booker Washington High School, right over there around Ahart. And so I had to bail out. And so I bailed out there, because once I got to the station, they was going to catch me. And I bailed out. Man, I was like a spinning top. Man, I tore all the bark off of my arms, my knees. And I was drunk, I guess, about 2 hours before I could come back around in my brain to settle out right.
King settled into the city and began working as a mechanic. He bought a Silvertone guitar and an amp from Sears and began teaching himself how to play.
I go back to Sears and Roebuck and I asked them, I said, do y'all have record players? They say, sure. So they are getting a little small one, real cheap, neat little gadget. So they had the record trucks during that time used to pass by Claiborne Street or sometime down Felicity Street. And I stopped and got me a couple of records, one by Jimmy Reed, one by Cunt Lightning Hopkins. And so I was listening at it, but I still couldn't catch up with it. I couldn't get it in here because it was too fast. So I checked it over real good and I see it on there. Well, it had 33 and a third, and it had 7 and 8, and then it had 45. So it automatically was on 45. And I said, well, maybe I put it on the next speed, it'll be just right. Wow, man, it went so fast, it was like a chipmunk. Never could do nothing with that fast. That was too fast. I couldn't understand anything at all then. So I put it on 33 and a third, and it drove. So that was just right. And so after that, I kept battling with it, that slow motion, until I learned to play Cunt Lightning's song, one of his songs. And I learned how to play one Jimmy Reed's song.
King's first gigs were in the neighborhood bars that flourished around New Orleans during the 1960s and 70s. His steadiest was at a joint on Perdido Street called the Busy Bee.
It had a terrific good sound, you know, like when we play that, but it was a brick building and the sound would hit the ceiling and the wall. I mean, it had a great sound and it was a great place and it was large and had the pool hall in it and everything. Had a place in it like a restaurant part of it where you could get food and stuff, y'all could meet, stuff like that. Really relaxing and just the people that dealt, that would come in down there, what I would call was synatic. You know, just love to fight and then butcher people, you know. And every time I played that, it was a battle. So that's why I give the name of the Bucket of Blood. Every night somebody got killed or they got butchered up so bad, you know, hospitalized. And so the only way I survived from it, they had the you know, the big rock roller jukebox. It was sitting in the corner. And I would go behind the jukebox when the battle started. And that's how I would keep from getting shot and get hit by a ball because I'd be behind the record player.
More on Little Freddie King's journey and a return to his old street corner when Still Singing the Blues continues.
Tell me you're going to get you one.
Back on Pogger Street, the bar that Little Freddie King calls the Last Chance Lounge is closed for the afternoon. But across the street, King spots four guys he knows from the neighborhood. One of them, a professional DJ named Bobby, has been following King's musical career for 30 years. The men fall into an easy conversation about the blues, the countryside, and how the two are connected.
See, can't know anybody sing blues. Right. You got to have that voice to sing blues. It ain't like you getting out there rapping. Anybody can get out there and rap, but to sing that blues, you got to have that tone. If you don't have that tone, a lot of people don't buy the record. That's blues, man. I love the blues.
That's right.
I got about 200 CDs in there, and I guarantee you 150 of them is nothing but blues.
Right. You got the real soul.
That's right.
I like all music, period, but the blues is really a part of me, what I love the best.
That's the original blues, you understand? When there was blues, there wasn't nothing else.
Exactly.
But gospel.
Right, right.
Because that's where originally where blues come from, gospel.
Exactly.
And the old black people in the field were singing these songs and stuff,
that's
you understand?
Right.
I'm talking about people like Bo Diller came along.
Right.
Hey,
that's
made
right.
music out of
that's
that.
It.
And that pile kicked me down 5 or 6 times, that give me the blues.
Yeah. You got some people just made for the field and some people not made for the field.
That's true.
I wasn't made for the field.
That's right. That's the truth. And I stayed up there until I got 14 years old, you know, doing farming work and stuff. And when I came from up there here, that did it. I mean, the city voodooed me right quick. I couldn't go back.
The spell that New Orleans cast on King gave rise to a musical style that's uniquely his. It remains Delta blues at its core, though it often throws away the traditional 12-bar structure, and it incorporates hints of the city's jazz and even second-line brass band music. Here's his drummer, Wacko Wade.
So he's familiar with the rhythms and the different structures of songs and all. But he's a purist at heart when it comes to the blues because he plays with his thumb. He don't play with a pick. And I asked him why. He said he could feel his strings with his finger. He can't feel them with a pick. And he plays blues patterns. You know, he sticks strictly to the blues, but he incorporates the different rhythms and sounds he did with other bands through the years and all. But He stays true to his music because it's inside of him.
King's gigs at clubs like the Busy Bee led to more work. He even toured Europe with John Lee Hooker in 1976. But like many other bluesmen, the hard life that gave rise to King's art almost destroyed him. He drank hard, and in the 1980s, his wife stabbed and shot him in a jealous rage. He was also prone to rages.
He's got a history of being a rough little guy. And when they saw him coming, they used to all say, "Oh Lord, here comes Freddie." And they knew there was gonna be trouble. And then I see him in these later years, you know, older, kinder, gentle guy, how mild-mannered, easygoing, and how he likes to listen to people. And then he starts telling stories.
After the altercation with his wife, King sobered up for good. The couple reconciled and took turns nursing each other until she died. King settled into monthly gigs at BJ's Lounge in Bywater, appearances at the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, and regular hours rebuilding car alternators. Hurricane Katrina upended this more settled life. After evacuating the city, King lived in Dallas for more than 2 years and thought he'd never come back. But through the efforts of groups like Habitat for Humanity, Sweet Home New Orleans, and the New Orleans Musicians Clinic, he has been able to make the Crescent City his home again. And the community effort goes well beyond Little Freddie King. Here's Musicians Clinic President Bethany Boltman.
Well, musicians in New Orleans have always lived under radar, and that's part of the way that music percolates out of the water almost. But before Hurricane Katrina, living under the radar, there was a real community that would sustain them. You could always live in a cousin's house in the Ninth Ward, or you had an old aunt, and she let you use her car. She only used it to go to church. That has all gone away. I heard a couple of times from musicians, they said, "We're not asking you to play God. We want to come home. We want to be back in our community. And it doesn't matter if we live another 6 months because we have a VA in Atlanta or Houston. It matters that we're home." And so at that point, we started using our donor money to get gigs for musicians. We continue to give them $100 per musician per gig, because that not only gives hope, but that helps fill their soul with joy.
For King, the biggest joy has been the ability to come home to New Orleans and to Musicians Village, the Upper Ninth Ward neighborhood built by Habitat for Humanity. His welcome home from Texas came as something of a surprise.
Wacko picked me up, and I thought he was going to bring me to the trailer. And then he didn't bring me to the trailer, and he kept driving. And I said, well, maybe going to Mandino on Canal Street for us to eat lunch. He didn't stop that. And he went back around, and he came back by BJ's. I said, maybe we're going to stop in BJ's and give him some beer or something. And he passed that up, and he just kept driving. And he didn't stop till he got right in front of the house here. And when he got in front of the house here, it was like a festival out there, you know, with the employees, the workmen, and the mayor and all the people out there, Harry Connors Jr. And I said, what is going on here? I said, could y'all really tell me what is going on around here? They said, yeah, you. I said, what, me? They said, yeah, good congratulations to you. I said, good congratulations what? To your new house. I said, well, y'all did it. I said, because I wasn't intending on to never come back down here to live. I said, but y'all made me come back.
Yeah, I went on back down there. Come on back home where I belong. What you say about how much a man?
If King's music was informed by his hard life, it has also been transformed by his warm welcome home.
Actually, it made it more greater than what I was. For God to spare my life and run me through all those tribulations and changes to put me back to work again, so that makes it more better for me. And I feel better playing the music, you know what I mean? And my soul and my spirit is more strong.
Some nights, you can still find Little Freddie King playing his guitar at BJ's, the Bywater Lounge, where he has performed on and off since the 1990s. The neighborhood has gentrified over the years, and the crowd is peaceable and middle class. King radiates an older man's calm, but at 69, he still makes the barroom tremble with the best gut bucket blues in town. I'm Richard Ziegler. Still Singing the Blues was written and produced by Richard Ziegler and Barry Yeoman. The narration was recorded by Dave Tilley. Support for this project comes from Filmmakers Collaborative, with major funding provided by Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Special thanks to Rachel McCarthy, Ben Samuel, Michael Hurt, Karen Leatham, Barry Unsley, Jamie DeLapa, Julia Botero, and Ivan Klesanen. You can see photos, listen to more audio, and meet additional musicians at our website, stillsingingtheblues.org.